Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Quick reminder that the new book is out. You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Your Colleagues, Employees, Even Family Up Their Game. This is a business book, but it's also a personal book. I wrote it from my experience as a coach, helping people change entrenched self-sabotaging behaviors. And I put all my knowledge and all of Peter Bregman, my co-author's knowledge, into a book to help you do the same thing with the people that you care about in your life. So it's available right now. It is for sale wherever books are sold. You know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstore.org, your local independent bookshop, my personal preference, if you can do that. And I would love for you to get a copy. That is one amazing way to support me, is to help the sales of the book, and to read it and implement it. And if you like, go on Amazon or somewhere and leave a review. All right, so let's get to today's episode. As a coach, I use language to help people get better, perform better, excel at what they're doing. I use language to help align teams. I use language to help people change their habits and behaviors. And so today I wanted to talk to someone else who does that, who's also written a book. You know, my methodology is in You Can Change Other People with my teacher and co-author Peter Bregman. And today I'm talking with Tom Reed, who's written a book called TASK, Performance-Based Communication. And I know Tom as a leader because he is the on-field captain of my Ultimate Frisbee team. And I have been noticing ways in which he has been using language to help us on the field get aligned, to help us be more efficient in practices, to help us perform better in games and tournaments. And so we got together to talk about all things communication around performance. Tom is primarily a business consultant, so a lot of the conversation revolves around business. We come up with a scenario in which I am the imaginary owner of an imaginary small chain of pizza restaurants, and he helps me work through some of the imaginary issues that I'm having with my company, with my imaginary company. And we also talk about personal behavior, relationships, health issues. So it's a wide-ranging conversation about all forms of communication in which the goal is to help people be better, do their best. So I hope you enjoy. Without further ado, Tom Reed, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you, Howie.
You're one of the few people who's ever recorded in studio.
I love it. I'm happy to be here. I am excited and fired up to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about communication. We're going to talk about probably Ultimate Frisbee. We're going to talk about your book, TASK, Performance-Based Communication. And I just want to start by just kind of introducing you in terms of, you're a guy I've played Frisbee with for many years.
For 20 years.
Close.
A long time, yeah.
Yeah. And, but I didn't really, like, you were just a guy I played with for many years, but then I joined the team, the old men's team from the Triangle of North Carolina, and you're our on-field captain. And I noticed that you were communicating with us in ways that seemed very intentional, very focused on both outcome and relationship. Mm-hmm. And I just had a sense that you weren't just sort of randomly talking, that there was a
people think I'm random. people think that I'm kind of winging it, but really I'm doing two things. One is I'm looking and listening for what's happening in the room. And the second thing is I'm trying to tie it back to whatever agreed upon strategy that we've aligned around is to be executed. So that's my initial algorithm on, you know, whether it's business development or team captain or any of those things. I like to start with, what are we trying to achieve? What are we trying to do? What kind of outcome are we trying to propagate or forward? So, for example, in any meeting, I want to know, why am I here? Why are you here? What is the outcome that we're trying to impact or influence? Even if it's just processing. So we're trying to frame a question. We're trying to answer a question. We're trying to understand a situation. That's something that I think many people don't spend enough time thinking about. It's like, well, it's 10 a.m., it's time to go to the management meeting.
Uh-huh. Well, so this is what
you want to go old school? Old school is like, okay, I know how we can get performance improvement. We'll just have everyone stand. Uh-huh. How about you go fuck yourself? How about that? Hey, listen, maybe standing is a good idea if it makes sense, or if it's fun, or if it's interesting, or it gets people revved up, whatever it is. But if you're doing it because you want people to be uncomfortable so that they'll be more efficient, that's not so cool.
Right. I just want to say, I was on a podcast yesterday, and before we started, the guy warned me that it was a family-friendly podcast,
yeah.
And hell and damn were considered curse words.
I've already plowed right through that.
So I was nervous the entire time.
Not
that
me.
I was, so we've
clearly I'm not.
we've taken care of that.
Right.
So I mean, one of the things I'm thinking of though is so you do business development. Mm-hmm. You've done social work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's something different though about like playing in a game.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, we're running around, we're bumping into each other, we're scoring, we're dropping it. Mm-hmm. There's emotions there.
Right.
And most of the time, like I've been captain. You were on teams where I was captain,
yeah,
at
sure.
Carrboro League.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I in those days, I was reacting.
Okay.
Like I would get upset and I would say something, right? Or I would be happy and I would say something.
Yeah.
Very passionate.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of like reacting is kind of the opposite to the idea of, what do I want to happen? Because
mm-hmm.
when I'm reacting, I'm just trying to take care of like my emotional needs in that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I see what you're saying. From a team perspective, I love the game of Ultimate Frisbee, which I hope the listeners, the viewers know what that is. But that's a tough game to draw analogies from. But I like to draw examples from baseball. Now, I know maybe it sounds a little hokey, okay? But I got to tell you, baseball has more business, what I call algorithms or things that you can... Okay. What you got? Oh, let me say, quick sidebar. 1956 World Series. The teams would be the New York Yankees versus the...
Brooklyn Dodgers.
The Brooklyn Dodgers, who are
game
now...
Game five.
Okay.
Don Larsen's perfect game.
Oh, wow! Okay, now how did you?
My dad was at the game.
Okay,
we'll leave that visible.
I love it. That was a great sidebar. So you support the baseball analogies?
Love baseball.
Okay, so here's the baseball analogy that I use. That you've heard me use in Ultimate Frisbee. There is a difference between making a mistake that's a thinking error versus a physical error. So, for example, if you're an outfielder and you're trying to throw somebody out at third base and you get the ball and you throw it because you're like, I'm going to be a badass and I'm going to throw it the whole way and I'm going to be the hero. And then you have an errant throw and you looked off the cutoff man. That will be a thinking error. So in terms of course correcting that behavior, that is... It's helpful to have the athlete or the worker to understand what is the difference between a thinking error and a physical error. Because in that moment, the outfielder thinks it's a physical error. Because he thought, I can do this. I'm really good at throwing the ball hard. Well, really, what we need you to do is hit the cutoff man.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when you're working with someone, I mean, you know, there are things that we don't do well. Just because we need practice and we need
sure.
to develop ourselves, and those are some conversations.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking to someone and you're seeing that they're making mental errors, and they're usually systematic.
Are you talking about in the workplace or in the sports field?
Let's say anywhere.
Most
people listening to this are not here mm-hmm. to get better at Ultimate Frisbee or baseball.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be more effective in their influence in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, we both have books about how to mm-hmm. talk to other people to accomplish stuff. Right. So we've talked on the sidelines about.
I want to know why, though. And I know I'm not saying, here's what I'm not saying. Uh-huh. What's your why? Not to be disrespectful to that person, but I really want to know why. Like, if someone wants to influence someone or impact someone or propagate something at work, let's just use work. I honestly want to know why.
As in, why bother?
More like, what's driving you?
Uh-huh.
Is it Colin Powell, who just passed away? If you've read his biography, one of his famous quotes is, "Fear is not a good motivator." Mm-hmm. And in the military, which, as you know, he served, fear is often used in to control behavior, to mitigate bad behavior.
Right.
That is used punishment and fear. And he was a proponent that fear is not a good motivator. So if someone's in the workplace and they have fear of losing their job or fear of not getting a bonus or fear of whatever, that's going to drive their behavior. I want to know why. So if fear is driving them, I need to know that in order for me to do my job.
Okay. So suppose fear is driving someone.
What? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
do you work with that, or do you try to?
This is where clinical social work meets the confluence of business.
Okay.
There's an expression in social work called therapy, start where the client is at.
All right. I'm gonna take notes.
Sure.
Because I'm gonna have to write this up later. and I like to look at the things that I've.
Is that
heard.
A takeaway?
That's a takeaway. Yes. You said it slowly, yeah. So I know it's a takeaway.
That's a good habit I've gotten into in presenting. Start where the client is at, and in all of my coaching, I talk about being authentic and aligned. Those are two things that are usually going to help in any communication. And I think people overestimate and get over-attended and focused on alignment, which is great, but they underestimate the power and influence of being authentic.
So define those.
Authentic. Well, let's do aligned. Aligned is easier. It's do two people or multiple people or even yourself. Are you aligned with yourself around what it is you're trying to do, why you're trying to do it, what is the plan, the strategy, the plan, and the execution? Let's call it that. So those are the three layers, right, of business. Strategy, plan, execution.
Okay.
Is there alignment? Cool. Now tell me if there's an authentic passion. Are we all on the same page on how we are doing what we're doing or how we are talking about it? I'll give you an example. I was doing a training where I was teaching people how to use the software that we had developed. And these two staff were working, and they weren't my staff. And I had made a comment in this big group that, hey, you know, you can... This software is so cool that you can use it. I was kind of, you know, selling the ease of use. And I said, it's cool because you can kind of help each other. It's that easy. And this one lady turned, she said, I don't give a fuck about her. And she wasn't joking. Like, it's kind of a cutthroat place. But I was like, whoa, she was not joking. So authentically, she, you know, her strength is that, you know, hey, she's trying to get done in her mind what she needs to get done and to stay focused on that. Cool, that's her positive intent. We can see that.
Mm-hmm.
But that has a ripple. It has an effect on those around her. Okay, so I think being authentic is, I didn't really define it. I think, you know, it's, you know, being true to yourself. And I bias towards being positive. If someone is authentically a horrible person, we got an issue. Mm-hmm. That's why you say, you know, hire slow, fire fast, right? You've heard that expression? Right. Hire slow, fire fast. If someone authentically sucks, you got to exit them. How about that for a coaching stance?
Well, so I want to go back to this idea of positive intent and this
sure.
and this woman who came from an authentic place saying, I don't give a fuck about her.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something valuable for the team in there.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So they're like... One person's authenticity,
mm-hmm.
often there's only one authentic person on the team, and they're the person who's ostracized, right? Because everybody else is playing nice. Everybody else is hiding their feelings, and there's only one person who's willing to risk.
I think everyone, in that situation, everyone is articulating their version of authenticity. So, for example, those who you say are, quote, hiding, there's for them, there's an authentic expression of wanting to keep a low profile, or I'm wanting to stay safe. Whatever it is that they're trying to do, that's their authenticity. But when it comes to business, you know, let's get back to business and baseball. Baseball, if you win 100 or 100 plus games, you're probably going to the playoffs. Like most baseball teams, they want to reverse engineer it. They want to win the World Series. Mm-hmm. Or you want to win the Super Bowl. That's also a good example. Football players don't play to go to the Super Bowl. That's a losing mentality. They play football to win the Super Bowl. So there's an authenticity, there's an alignment that the team can have for why should I hold this block a certain way? Why should I fire up out of my stance when I'm tired? Why should I do that? Because as a team, we're all aligned and we each have our own authentic way of contributing to that. Some people are cheerleaders. Some people are get your head out of your ass people. Each one of them are authentic.
Okay. So what does inauthenticity look like then?
That horrifies me. Inauthenticity and apathy are the two things. If you asked me, Tom, what are the two things that intimidate or scare you when you're coaching business, mainly business? Those two things. Because if people truly don't care, it's like shut down the assembly line, put on the emergency brake. We got a problem. We should not move forward until this problem is resolved. Uh-huh. Apathy, the lack of care for the outcome, scares the shit out of me. Okay, and then inauthenticity scares me because what it implies is that there's mobility in what someone is trying to achieve. So for example, one day I want to be on time. Next day, I don't care about being on time. Next day, I'm going to hurt your feelings. Next day, I'm going to be nice to you. Whatever it is, there's not a path that they've picked.
So inauthenticity is diagnosed by inconsistency on sort of these.
I wouldn't use the word diagnosed because it's a clinical word, but I would say it's indicated or that's how I would look at it.
Because one of the phrases I heard you say earlier is positive intent. Mm-hmm. And so I love that you're looking at this person who is, saying, I don't care about my teammate, and saying, well, there's positive intent behind that.
Why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I start there?
Well, so then you're also saying that these people who are hiding are also, they're trying to protect themselves. Yeah. There's always positive intent.
They have positive intent too, yeah. This is where people get jammed up. In fact, the book really is, you could say, it's if you could pick one thing in the book and say, Tom, what's the thing that, there's only one thing I could take from this book. What is it? Assume positive intent. Why? Because it's there. Where people get jammed up is when they go, I don't see it. Or they say, their behavior is so bad, there is no positive intent. To which I say, sorry, you're wrong. And it becomes a negotiation of whether someone's open or not to be able to hear the conversation. But ultimately, you separate out, okay? You bifurcate behavior from intention. And if you take your time to do that, it solves all of the dissonance about, are they a good person? Did they do a good thing? We can separate all that out. The behavior and the intention are separate. An intention can be good and a behavior can be bad. In fact, it happens a lot.
Right. Well, that's in psychology, I guess. That's the fundamental attribution error.
Okay.
Whereas whatever I do wrong, I had good intentions. I meant to do well, but I messed up, or I didn't have the right information, or I was overwhelmed.
That last part is really tricky. So let's slow down a little bit. I tried to do the right thing all day long. People are driven to try and do the right thing. Now, this last thing about information, it's changing right in front of us right now. Like the algorithms what's the AI? What does that stand for again?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, artificial intelligence is grabbing what interests you and me and in our news feeds, and it's shaping and giving you that and feeding every person who's a user of that service. Now is getting different vantage points of news, for example. So in any given day, we can look at the same newspaper and go, well, I would debate you on this topic, and I feel this way, you feel that way, but we're running off the same information.
Right.
But the way that we're getting information now is so biased because it's leaning towards however we like to use information.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, so when I mess up, mm-hmm. my explanation is always assuming my positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
Because I always want to do the right thing, mm-hmm. right?
I believe you.
But when I look at other people's behavior, mm-hmm. my default is to blame them, is to say, well, they have bad intentions,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's this you know, it's we're putting a different standard on other people's behavior than ourselves.
What do you think for you it would be the action or the accommodation to not have that first reaction be to question their intention? What would it be for you, do you think?
So for me, mm-hmm. it's very often when I judge somebody else and I go, oh, that person's an asshole, I feel a little bit bad myself.
Okay.
Right. So often I start with myself and I say, well, you know, I'm having a negative judgment about them. Why?
Good question. What's the answer to that question?
So the answer to that question is because some value of mine mm-hmm. is being threatened. Right. Like whenever anybody.
Okay.
So like I can always say like a question I love to ask about other people's behavior is assuming positive intent. What could be mm-hmm. an explanation for their behavior?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if my kids don't call me on my birthday,
mm-hmm.
my mind can immediately go to they're selfish. They don't care about me.
Right.
But I can also say, assuming positive intent, what might some other explanations be?
Mm-hmm.
It could be they're busy.
Right.
They forgot.
Yeah.
They're doing a surprise party mm-hmm. later. Right. Like, and the point is, I don't know which is the right one. But mm-hmm. isn't it interesting how I almost always choose the worst one? My kids hate me. That's why.
The only thing that concerns me, and concern is a strong word about what you just said, is that it's reflexive to some degree. Like I hear you saying it's a bit reflexive. When you see some of that bad behavior externally, that you pretty much say there's a thing you do. So I think that's easy to course correct should you choose to take this mission, like Mission Impossible. It's letting go of something. So that first reaction, you call that like a filter or whatever you want to call it. If you just let that go and force yourself to take a beat where you make yourself not label the behavior or even question the intention, just take a beat for a second mm-hmm. and then take a breath. And if you skip the judging part, just if you can, and just ask yourself, I wonder what their positive intention is. Now, that's a good habit to get into. It's harder to do, like, say when you're driving and someone cuts you off. How about that?
Yeah. Right.
That's tough, right?
Well, that's the amygdala hijack.
I like that. Let me write that down.
Yeah.
I like that. The amygdala hijack. Okay.
Well, the point is, like, when we are in a neurological state mm-hmm. of fight or flight, like the part of our brain that can do what you say mm-hmm. is the neocortex.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are, you know, when a car cuts us off and we think we're about to die,
yep.
like literally the blood gets shunted from this part.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, like.
There's an adrenaline spike.
At that point, I think mm-hmm. breathing is the only thing we can do.
If you want to be pro-social, what you're talking about now is a construct of, if I want to be pro-social and I get hit with a fight or flight stimulus,
right.
the first thing I should do is take a breath of oxygen. Is that true?
Yes.
That's if you want to be pro-social.
Well, or, but if I want to, if like, let's say pro-sociality yeah. isn't necessarily my value, but what's the outcome you want? That's your first question. It's like, what are we doing here? I'm on the highway. I want to get somewhere safely.
Well, slow down. Wait a second. What was your intention when you got up that day? Did you set an intention for yourself? Like, I'm gonna be an 8 or a 9 or 10 on pro-social behavior throughout the day. Did you set that intention? Yeah. Let's assume you did for a second.
Okay.
Now I have a series of behaviors and attitudinal shifts that I'm going to do to support that that intention. So then when I get cut off, the first thing I do, I feel that adrenaline spike, is I take a breath of oxygen because I know I'm not going to score 8, 9, or 10. Mm-hmm. on my intentionality if I allow myself to be reactive. Is that fair?
Yeah.
So that's the construct that I'm talking about.
So something as simple as, here's a value that I really hold dear, and I never think about it until I transgress
Bingo.
It.
Bingo. That's what I'm saying.
And then I feel bad for transgressing
yep,
it.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly. So the shift in that is, and I'm talking literally at the beginning of the day, take 10 seconds
mm-hmm.
to set your course. What's my intention for the day? And at the end of the day, you take 10 seconds to do what? To grade yourself. You're the judge and jury. How did I do on whatever metric you're doing? I like to do scaling of 1 to 10, mm-hmm. with 10 being super awesome and 1 being a disaster. That's it. Uh-huh.
But I hear people saying, but Howie and Tom, I don't have 20 seconds in my day. I'm too busy.
Okay, that's fine. Tell me a little bit more about this person. I'm fascinated by a person who is that busy that they literally say, because it's for real. Because everyone goes to the bathroom, for example, and there's certain things you do where you can actually multitask. Right. But well, go ahead, yeah. Tell me about this person.
No, it's. I'm thinking of myself.
Of all the
good things I could be doing, yeah. and I don't do them. I said, well, I'm too busy for that. I got too many. Like, mm-hmm. That's the point. Like 20 seconds in the day. Mm-hmm. I have my coaching clients. I mm-hmm. want them to spend 5 minutes in the beginning of the workday and 5 minutes at the end
that's
of the workday.
That's too much. That's too aggressive. They're not going to do that. but they're going to tell you they did it, but they're not going to do it.
when they do it, the feedback I always get is, boy, that saved me 3 hours.
Right, for real. I get it. I get the value of it if you can get them there. So really what we're talking about is how committed a person is, in this example it was you, but how committed a person is to their path. In this example, we talked about pro-social behavior, for example. My path is I'm trying to be a pro-social, community-driven, good person, whatever it is I'm trying to do. Well, that's a pathway that gets reinforced, etc., and it's a commitment. And I think a lot of people... I'm not trying to, to shame anybody. I think a lot of people are kind of meandering through with the best intentions, but they don't really have a path.
Yeah. Well, if you're not intentional in the way you describe, mm-hmm. your path is going to be prescribed by everybody else.
Bingo. You are held hostage to people cutting you off or not. If someone cuts me off, not to be like I'm the Dalai Lama, if someone cuts me off, I have a choice at that point that I can engage in my adrenaline reaction, or I can take a breath and be thankful that I'm not in an accident, for example. Those are my decisions. Now, what we haven't talked about is when people get a stimulus rush. Fuck you, man. You cut me off. Whatever it is, for some people that feels good. To right. ventilate that energy.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, okay. I want to have been a pro-social person sometimes more than I want to be a pro-social person.
Like, say some more.
Being pro-social often means biting my tongue, not giving in to that adrenaline rush.
Okay.
When I'm scared, I don't like being scared. I'd rather be angry.
Whoa, that's big. Let me take that in for a second. I don't like to be scared. I prefer or rather be angry. Can you say why that is?
I think being angry makes me feel like I'm in control. I think this is
that's fascinating.
Right. It's like, so when I'm working with someone, their first emotion mm-hmm. is usually covering up a second or third emotion.
Right, right. Like for example, I'm so angry. Well, may I ask, did it start with irritation or frustration? Yeah, I was really irritated. I was frustrated, and then I was angry. It's like, okay. So let's back up to how are you communicating when you're irritated and frustrated? I see that a lot in my work, that people tend to skip over those pretty important points. Now, you bring up a good point about I feel more empowered or in control when I'm angry, which I think is an illusory. I think that's an illusory bias.
Oh, well, there's a saying in the Jewish folklore book in the first century that, who is the mightiest? The one who masters their own emotions.
Yeah, okay. So, I like that. I think we're saying the same thing here. Because when you think of anger, any treatment around anger is called anger control. Because when you're angry, you're out of control by definition.
Right.
Like, the adrenaline response. And when you're full of adrenaline, literally anything can happen. You can say things you don't mean or intend. You can do things that you don't mean to do or intend, then go, why did I do that?
Yep.
So it's funny to me that you say when I feel angry, I feel like I'm in control. That's an illusory bias, I think.
Right, and especially if we're in relationship with someone else mm-hmm. and they're making us angry, right? That's air quotes for people who are listening.
Okay.
They're making us angry. What we want to do is control them.
Yep, yep.
And when we're angry, not only are we not controlling them, but we're losing control of ourselves.
Very powerful. If people are willing to take it on. I was looking over here at your book, The Four Steps to Help Colleagues and even Family Up Their Game. I got positively distracted by that.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to know like what up their game meant, because it's highlighted.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I'll get positively distracted by your okay. book. You talk about performance-based communication.
Yep. Okay.
Like when I first saw that and I heard that phrase yeah. from you,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, like that's naming a thing yeah. that doesn't have a name.
That's right.
As opposed to yeah. like that should be like there shouldn't need to be that phrase. You should just have the phrase called communication.
Correct, correct.
But the fact, you know, just the way I think about food, like you shouldn't have a phrase for health food. You should just have like food and junk food.
It's a great, you know, this is why you have a PhD, right? What's your PhD in?
Health studies.
Yeah. So you have a PhD, and that's how the PhD people think like that. That will tell you that's a very shrewd observation about like performance-based communication is not something I woke up one day and went, I want to call what I do performance-based communication. What I did was saw decades of the difference between people who tried really hard and people who actually got outcomes.
Yeah.
Because they look on paper exactly the same. But there was something that those two groups did differently to have different outcomes. And the word performance is at the root of it. In other words, here's another expression. Performance is not a dirty word. What does it mean when you have a performance evaluation, for example? The people are like, oh shit, I'm getting a performance evaluation. What does it mean to perform? And do people understand that? So the reason I titled the book The Task, Performance-Based Communication, is positive people want positive outcomes. People with chaos, if you really sit down and talk with them, they'll tell you, you know what I really want? I want more harmony. Really? Have you looked at yourself?
Right.
But when you sit down with them, you find out people tend to cluster around things like, I want the best for my children. I want these positive outcomes. I want harmony in my life. So even though every family, every person is unique, like a snowflake, they're similar, cold and frosty and icy. You know, there's similarities. So performance-based communication is about owning and saying, I'm communicating with you and I'm trying to be effective.
Right. Well, to me, yeah. it's the difference between reacting and responding. So just
tell me your thoughts about that.
Right. So when I react, you say something and I just blurt out something in the moment to kind of settle my internal state in this moment. Whereas where I'm responding, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the outcome. Like when you said, mm-hmm. you know, your communications on the Frisbee field, you're always thinking about what are we collectively trying to accomplish
right.
and is my communication, you know, none of us gets it right all the time.
Sure, sure.
But the question, you know, if we're asking the question and it's in the top of our mind, mm-hmm. is this likely to help us get where we're going?
My first question is always, was it a thinking mistake or a physical mistake? It's always my first question, as a sports coach. It's always my first question, because if someone is making a thinking error, they're likely to keep making that error because they think they're doing the right thing.
Right. Well, and I would argue, you know, for myself
sure.
and for teams that I've coached, that a repeated mm-hmm. physical error is usually a thinking error.
Okay.
If I make one bad throw or I drop something, that's one thing.
My disagreement with that would be like you are co-opting what I call thinking error, and you're using it like as a cognitive processing error, like in other words, stinky thinking.
Okay.
Like you're questioning your ability, and it's degrading your physicality because of what's going on in your head. I'm using thinking error in a very narrow context, which is there are a set of expectations.
Okay.
There are a set of strategies that we're trying to achieve, and you either do them or you don't. It's black and white.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it would be a different level of thinking error.
Yours is more like sports psychology.
Okay.
That's what you're talking about.
Right. Like if I drop it because I'm looking at the next pass.
I would call that a physical error.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we could play Stump the Chump all day long. That would be a physical error. I'd have no problem with that. I might say to you, hey, keep your eye, you know, on the disc. Or I might say a cue, mm-hmm. but my coaching is going to have a tone. It's going to be different.
Okay. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So how does this apply in sort of like, you know, business? Like what are thinking errors versus execution errors in business?
Well, that's a good question. Let's pick a business, any business. I don't care. Let's just chop it up.
Okay, pizza restaurant.
I love it. A pizzeria.
Yes.
Okay, a pizzeria. Okay, so are you the owner, manager, or worker?
I'm the owner.
You're the owner. Okay, and as the owner, is it a single shop? It's three, but it's not a franchise.
It's not a franchise.
Okay, yeah, three of them.
It's three in the metro area.
All right, last question. Do you want to have a franchise? Is your ambition to have 100 of them, you know, to be the new Papa John's, or is it to have three of them to have a build a legacy for your wonderful children?
Yeah, second one.
The second one. Okay, build a legacy. Now I have a better understanding, at least initially, of what it is you're trying to do and why you started three stores. Okay, so what is some of the things that are, you know, Mr. I'll call you Smith, so I don't use it like a cultural. What are some of the things that are jamming you up? What are some of the hurdles that you see coming at you?
Well, hiring's really hard right now. I've got supply chain issues with some of the takeout stuff, the boxes, for example, or the little cups that you put the sauces in.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the stores is in a bad neighborhood, and people are a little bit scared to go there sometimes.
So be people, stuff, and location. Of those three problems that you just mentioned, is there one of them that sequentially speaks to you with more importance?
Well, hiring is...
It does?
It's the hardest thing is to find, you know, good people.
When you heard
people.
Me say before, hire slow, fire fast, as a pizzeria owner, what did you feel when you heard me say that? What came to mind for you?
I was like, yeah, it'd be great to have that luxury, right. But I need somebody to mix the dough and to get up at 4 in the morning and make sure that there's yeast proofing.
How many staff do you have per store?
It's about a dozen, but maybe five working at a time.
Okay. And you have one manager per store?
Yeah.
Your trusted people? How often do you meet with these trusted people?
Well, I mean, really, I started the store, so I got three, so I wouldn't have to like be the point person. So every couple of weeks, usually they call me when there's a problem.
Okay, I'll come at it from a different azimuth. From the customer perspective, what experience do you as an owner want for every customer that comes to one of the three Smith's pizzerias? That's funny. I don't know that there is a Smith pizzeria in the U.S. That'd be funny. All right. What experience do you want for every one of your customers to have?
So I want them to come in and feel welcome.
Okay, feel welcome.
I want them to feel like they're being seen and taken care of, and I want them to have a quality experience in terms of food, cleanliness, timeliness.
So that's pretty comprehensive. I would expect that when people come to the pizzeria, that the thing they want most is a good-tasting pizza. Is that a fair... I could be wrong about that. So in other words, if the service was a little bit like, you know, off-putting, but damn, that pizza is good. What is it that people want more when they come to the pizzeria?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of good pizza places. People want to come and feel good.
Okay, so customer experience.
Customer experience.
I love it. So you're landing on that. So here's where all this conversation leads to this. You as an owner are coaching these three managers. Those three managers are then coaching the other, you know, 14 people or so per store. There are 15, right, per store. The word variability is not good in business. Right. So if you engaged me and I did an assessment and I talked to each of the managers and all the staff and I say, what is, you know, what's important? Mm-hmm. And I got 15 different answers per store, it's likely what would be the problem. When we talk about alignment and authenticity, is every person there fired up to make a quality pizza and give a quality experience to the customer? Does it get any more simple than that? That's clear, simple, and compelling, which is another thing that I propagated in the book.
Okay, so how does that relate to either, to the kinds of errors, thinking or execution?
So in that situation, if someone, let's see, someone is rude to a customer, maybe that, how about that an example, okay? So someone's rude to a customer, I would call that a behavioral error. And I guess at the end of the day, you can certainly have a physical or what I call behavioral error and a thinking error. It would be both. That's why my voice tone is changing, because I'm horrified. I'm like, it could actually be the equivalent of I'm trying to throw the ball really hard and I'm throwing it in the wrong direction. You know, I'm making thinking and physical errors.
Well, so let me see. Like, someone, the morning shift person doesn't come in on time, and so by the time it's noon and you just want to start serving lunch pizzas, there's no dough ready. So the person just overslept.
Yeah, that's cataclysmic. So, you know, in these examples, I say that's cataclysmic because, you know, in baking and pizza business, like there is an ordinal sequence that has to happen. So you're out of business if that's, you know, there's no, you're not going to be able to serve any pizza. So in that situation, I would say to the owner, I got good and bad news for you. The good news is I understand the problem. The bad news is you are the problem. That's what I would say.
Okay, so now the business owner, me in this case.
Because what is your job ultimately? What would you say is your one job? Oh, my job is to own 3 stores. That would be the wrong answer. My job is to make money and be left, leave me the fuck alone unless there's a problem. That would also be the wrong answer. The right answer would be you are obsessed with coaching your 3 managers so that they have authenticity and alignment around the strategy, the plan, and executing. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all ties together.
Right. So in that case, what you're really saying is an owner whose expectation is this is a gumball machine for money is exhibiting the sin of apathy.
Keep going. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Right. They're not taking responsibility for.
Right. It's a blind spot. I mean, that's an easy word to say in business. Like, oh, that's a blind spot. But actually, blind spots really are, how do you say, born out of bias. You know about illusory bias, right? The social psychology around illusory bias. Like, you know, the radio show, Lake Wobegon, where all the women are beautiful, the men are smart. No, the women are strong, the men are smart, and the children are good looking, right?
The children are all above average.
All above average, that's right. The women are strong, the men are all good, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's a nod to the theory of illusory superiority, where we all think we're a little better at stuff than we really are.
Right, so, like the great studies about asking people about their sense of humor.
Yeah.
Like 95% of people think they have above average sense of humor.
And intelligence.
Driving ability.
I love
and
it.
My favorite one, they asked a bunch of social scientists, do they feel like they are, where are they in terms of self-awareness? And like 98% of them said they're more self-aware than
their peers.
Their peers.
Which is statistically impossible, right? So you're a PhD, you think that's funny. See, PhDs think that joke is funny. But I get it too. I think it is hilarious. Also, that is the theory of illusory superiority. And it ties into the cognitive dissonance theory about we're wired to do things we think are the right thing. You know, we're wired for our behavior and our thoughts to run in the same direction. You know about cognitive dissonance theory was Leon Festinger, 1950s.
Okay.
He was a sociologist. He was trying to help understand what the hell happened in World War II with the Nazis and all the atrocities of the Holocaust. Like, how could people put a picture, post it on the wall of their job site, okay, which had a glass window, a small glass window, looking into one of the showers that had gassed human beings. And they found a picture of a little girl where the worker was looking through the window to make sure all the bodies were dead, the people were dead. But he had a little picture, like any other workplace. You had the picture of your family right there.
Mm-hmm.
And people, like, how could that man go home to that little girl every night? After his shift was done, he'd go home down, you know, a couple of miles down the road. How could he do that? And the answer is, because they weren't people to him. They were rats.
Mm-hmm.
He was exterminating the less than.
Yeah.
Okay. So that preserved the consonance for the human condition of how could a human being do this to another human being? Easy. They weren't human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So cognitive dissonance is an extremely important foundational theory that most people understand, but they don't reference it enough.
Okay. So how does that connect to blind spots? Because you said the bias underlies blind spots.
Right. Because people think that they're well-intentioned and that they're doing the right thing and that they're on point because they want to think well of themselves.
Okay.
That's not an unusual thing. That's not an unreasonable thing.
Right.
But it's not a fully informed thing.
Okay. So let's go there. So we are definitely well-intentioned. We don't have blind spots, and we want to help others.
Oh, I have blind spots. Okay, but I'm well-intentioned, but I got tons of blind spots. So I'm keep bumping into them.
Right. No, but let's okay. Like we have fewer blind spots about other people. Like we can see other people more clearly.
Okay.
So there's someone in your life who is trapped by one of these cognitive biases. They have a blind spot, and everything they're doing is for cognitive
consonance,
and they want to feel good about themselves.
Yep.
How do we talk to them without making them feel bad about themselves?
Great question. That's why I always start with, what do you want? It's not that, you know, what's your why? I really authentically want to know, what is driving you? Like, what are you super excited to do, accomplish? What are you trying to achieve? Because that will tell me what they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. Once I know what they're passionate about, then we. So, if, say someone says, "I'm pissed off at my boss,"
yeah,
really pissed, and I know that what's driving them is they want to make money. They're like, "I just want to sell a lot of cars," and dude, get the hell out of my way. I could sell more cars.
Okay,
I know you're driven to sell cars. So, if I say to you, "I wonder if there's a pathway where you could manage the conflict and still sell cars, would you be open to doing that?" I'm just wondering, if that were theoretically possible, would you be willing to do that? And invariably, people are like, yeah, sure, I'd be willing to do that. And just try and start breaking down where things are going wrong. So it's like you're giving people bite-sized pieces that line of information that clear up some of this blind spot. Because if you give them too much too quickly, people get resistant, right? Because you're creating dissonance because they believe they're smart. They believe the boss is the problem. Tom, you're not listening to me.
Yeah.
I just told you the boss is the problem and you're telling me I'm the problem. No. I'm just trying to help figure out how can you sell those cars that you want to sell.
Right. The other thing I'm thinking about, and this is, you know, in my book, the second step is identify an energizing outcome.
Okay.
Exactly the same thing.
Yep, okay.
And what's suddenly coming to me as I listen to you talk is the other thing that asking you about what you want does is it automatically validates you.
Okay. I'm cool. Listen, I think that's cool. For me, that's not what I'm after. I'm after a very clear communication where you are confident that I understand what you are trying to achieve and that I am not having a judgment reaction to it. Say you say, I want to sell 500 cars. And I go, you can't do that. Like that would be a judgment reaction, right? I just want to know what it is that you want to do. And that authenticity, again, there's authenticity and there's alignment. Okay, I'd like to align to help you. Are you willing to allow me?
Right.
To help you.
Well, I'll tell you why I think the validation is so important, because clearly outcome is important strategically for just like, where are we going, right? We want to put the destination in the GPS.
I think that's true, and I don't know if I can explain like why that's true, but we wanted to put at the time, it was a man on the moon. We were going to be putting a woman on the moon soon. We want to put a man on the moon, right?
Right.
That you can't get any more clear than that other than it was, we want to put him on the moon and return him safely, right? That was the articulation.
Right.
That goal, I kind of co-opted this piece, I apologize, but like that goal is so powerful because set in 1961, a target to achieve in that decade, as he would say, it drove, 400,000 people to work on the project. And out of that project, among other things, was born the internet.
Right.
The goal was to go to the moon and back. and we got the internet. Which one was bigger? I don't
Right. But in the context of someone with a blind spot.
Yes.
To then, if we're then, you know, here comes Tom. He's going to fix me. I'm already feel like, okay, the boss is upset with me. I'm doing something wrong. I'm the boss is the problem. He doesn't understand. For you to be in, to then say, what do you want? Mm-hmm. Immediately makes you an ally and allows that person to loosen a little bit of their defensiveness.
And do you trust me that I mean what I say?
Well, do I? I mean,
if we were role playing, and I said, "Would you trust me that that's what I was after?"
Well, I might not know, but you know, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt as long as you're asking. You know,
here's what I would tell you: if you were a client, I would not move forward until I was fully confident that you trusted that I was authentic about that. How would I know that? I would ask you.
Uh-huh.
That's how important it is to me. For the other person to know that I am listening and understand what they're trying to do. And to be frank with you, to lay up. I'm trying to think. I don't know that I've ever run into a situation, even with people who've abused their kids. You think, God, how do you change their behavior? Mm-hmm. People are abusing. I'm talking about badly abusing their kids, by the way.
Right. And you might say something of your background, like why, like so that doesn't come out of the blue for people.
Sure. Therapy, working with families, with court adjudicated youth, youth who, that means like they, maybe they're in a gang, they're kind of running amok, families who have been referred to the Department of Social Services because they were verbally or physically abusing their children. So the idea is, you know, the systems, the stakeholders are trying to protect. So I have done a lot of family work.
Right. I wanted to establish your credibility around that. So you're not like
so this, random.
That's different from a pizza restaurant that we just made up. Like
it
that,
certainly
that was
is.
Your life for many years.
Yes, yeah. So I have a clinical license to practice therapy and 30 plus years doing that in addition to all my business stuff. Yeah. Okay, so where were we going with that?
Well, so the person who has a blind spot that we want to help them.
Yeah, that's right. Building trust with people with hard to trust people. In other words, people who are like abusing their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you build trust in a way to affect an outcome, to propagate positive outcome? That's not a layup. Mm-hmm. That is not a layup.
Well, so then let's go back to what you said was the core message, was assume positive intent.
Yep.
How do you assume positive intent about someone who's abused their kids?
Well, how do you do it is habit. You said, how do I assume positive intent? It's repetition.
All right. Well,
that's how.
What would it look like?
Now, there you go. What would it look like? It's simple. I wonder why they just said to their kid, you're a piece of shit. And you'll never amount to anything. That's a pretty, what I would call it. I would call that, you know, bad. And I would say that's kind of horrific in a way. But I would, in my experience, it's pretty low intensity. But let's use that as an example. Because most people would think that's pretty bad.
Right.
I say, gosh, you know what? I'm searching my brain. I don't see the positive intent. But I got the person right in front of me. And so I can ask them. I noticed before when you were speaking that you said to Jonathan, hey, you're a piece of shit and you're not going to amount to anything. And you also seemed like you were, you know, pretty energized by that. I'm wondering, it seemed like a very passionate articulation to me. I'm wondering where that's coming from. I'm wondering what's driving you for that. Now, do you see how authentic, like I really want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my mind and in my facial expression are aligned, which is, I want to know what's your positive intent. Maybe I don't use those words because they might be confusing to a person who doesn't know the lingo. But it's clear to them that I'm not playing poker where I'm like, I'm going to get you to open up and then I'm going to go, aha, but you got to stop cursing at your kid.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to do that. I want to know. And you know what they tell me?
What?
Tom, I am worried that Jonathan's going to be dead when he's 21 years old. He's going to become a statistic. So I am fighting to get his attention, to pay attention, to do schoolwork, to you know, do all these things. And I'm really struggling. I will fight anybody. There's an expression, never get between a mama bear and her cub.
Yeah.
I will fight anyone who tries to block me. Okay. Well, now I understand. That's the positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is to not turn into Dr. Phil. Well, how's that working for you? Yeah, no, uh-uh. But here's a question. How would you like it to work? How would it look if you felt you were achieving your goals as a parent? Mm-hmm. How would Jonathan talk? What would he be doing? Like, what would that look like if he were successful? Mm-hmm. What's your vision for him? There's a lot to, you see, all of a sudden now we're having part B of that conversation because there's no resistance.
Right.
Why? Because I, as the intervention, which, and it could be coaching if we're doing business, I'm not judging you. I just want to understand you.
Right. And the importance of getting them to articulate that outcome, because at some point you're going to have to deal with that behavior, right? Some version of them saying, boy, that's not getting me what I want.
Yeah, because in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, it'd be great if the kid went to college. Like, I have my own bias. I don't know that they or he wants to go to college or have a career in this or that as an accountant or what. I don't know. What do I know? See, I got to put my stuff and leave it to the side. Same with business coaching. Oh, I think you should make $1 million. Yeah. I think you should do this many sales. It's not for me to say. I want to know what's driving you.
Right. And so, you know, for people who are longtime listeners to my podcast, we talk about, like, you know, helping people change their health habits.
Ooh, I like this topic.
This can be very similar. So, like, if, you know, if I come home and I see my kid eating junk food, it's very easy for me to judge.
It's triggering. It can be triggering.
It's triggering, right? So that habit of assuming positive intent, of being able to say, well, you know, this is a tough time for him. This food makes him feel good in the moment. We all need to feel good. We all need to feel comfortable and supported. And even like without even having all the social work skills or the therapy skills or the business coaching skills, simply approaching with compassion, I think, can make a big difference.
If you want to have a pro-social relationship with this person, and if you want to have the best chance at a positive outcome, that's the strategy. If you just want to ventilate, because you're like, fuck it, I don't want to see you eating Twinkies anymore. Well, you can do that too. That's your choice.
Right. And the irony is, the thing that I'm objecting to about their behavior, you're just doing something in the moment to make you feel good and you're not getting the outcome you want, is exactly what I'm doing when I'm ventilating on them.
100%. Exactly. You know what they say? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree in that situation. That's a great point.
That, you know, that almost any time that I'm indulging my emotions at the expense of outcome, like, I'm projecting that judgment of myself onto somebody else.
That's tricky. You know, this is where I think a lot of people contend to drop off in terms of understanding or interacting with the material, because I think people get a sense like, nah, you're overthinking it.
Yeah.
You know, but the truth is, I would say you're underthinking it. You know, like practice, we know practice makes permanent. And you don't want to just do repetitions for the repetition's sake. You want to do quality. Quality repetitions performed is practice makes permanent. What are you practicing? And why are you practicing? Do you not have 5 seconds to set an intention or 5 minutes to spend the beginning of your day if being successful is that important to you? So all of a sudden, it becomes more clear why people want to do that. Yeah, I have found that people in business interact with the quote clinical material more fluidly than clinicians who I train. Huh. I find that fascinating. I have a theory about why that is.
Oh, well, let me give you my theory
first. Oh, yeah, please, yeah.
In business, we keep score, so it's easier to tell, and it matters more.
Yeah, so my theory is actually it lines up with what you're saying. I think in business, people are always looking for tools to get them a better score. Mm. Like, you know, baseball, like I have a 33-ounce bat, but maybe a 32-ounce bat is the better bat.
Yeah.
With a lighter bat, I can swing faster. You know, people are always looking for the edge, the tools, and they're quick to adopt things that they feel will help them attain their goals. Whereas clinicians approach their training and their postgraduate supervision with a schematic. Like, hey, this is how I practice. And any evolution of that, I should be very introspective and I should stress test it and challenge it and wait before I implement it. There's a lot more caution, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I just find it interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the things I love about anything where you keep score, whether it's business or sports, is that the winners are proving something.
Like, yeah, keep going. I love it. I love what you're saying. I'm all about it. Like, right. Excel spreadsheets look to me like the musical score of an opera. Like, all the notes, the melodies, everything is in there.
Yeah.
If you look at it.
Well, so I'll work with someone who wants to lose weight.
Okay.
And they don't want to look at the scale because they get emotionally triggered if it goes up a pound. And we got to work on that. We have to work on reinterpreting what the scale means.
Before we go too far, would you agree that those clients of yours, they want to be more healthy? Well, they're saying, "Hey, I'm paying you to help me lose weight."
Yeah.
But they're really saying, "I want to live longer, or I want to be more active, I want to be more healthy."
Rarely.
Right, they rarely say that.
No, they rarely think it at first.
Right, but what ultimately do you find that's driving their behavior?
What initially drives a lot of the behavior is vanity.
They don't look good.
They look good.
So they want to look better.
Yep. Okay. It's only once they start doing things so that they're more in integrity, then they can access these deeper, profound motivations.
See, I like what you're saying. I wouldn't call it vanity. Because if someone looks in the mirror, they don't like what they see, and they say, "Tom, I don't like what I see," then the first question is, "Well, what do you want to see?"
I'm using vanity. I don't mean it to be a pejorative, but it's I want to look better. And you know what? People don't articulate that either because they're ashamed.
Why do they want to look better?
We all want to be attractive. It's a human need.
I like it. Right? So they want to be attractive to other people. To themselves?
To themselves.
Now you have this attraction. What are you doing with this attraction?
They're not.
No, no, you're role playing. You're your client. You're your client. You've gotten this level of attractiveness. What are you doing with that?
Well, I'm just happier at work.
Bingo. I think you just nailed it. I'd be happier. I would be happier. That's powerful, dude. That's powerful.
But then, you know, so then the person is unwilling to look at the scale, right?
Of course not. The scale is the enemy.
Yeah.
The boogeyman.
Right. So when they do.
But you want them to look at the scale because you want them reality check, right?
The scale or your neck to waist.
Okay.
But reality checks are very scary to people who have been burned by reality.
Yeah. I agree with that. I'm a big fan of data. Data-driven decision making, right? That we're talking about.
Yeah, that's why business and sports can give us. Think of how many, like coaching came from sports.
Correct.
Right. It didn't start in the business world. It didn't start in the life world. It started in sports because
you could actually get more out of the similar talent and then have better outcomes.
Yeah, like, you know, you can read stories about, you know, someone like Andre Agassi was, you know, losing every tennis match to people who were not nearly as talented as him until he got Brad Gilbert as a coach.
Yeah.
And he stopped trying to win every point.
Right.
And all of a sudden he became one of the, you know, dominant players of his age.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we can see that in places where we keep score, it's really easy to make progress if we're willing to look at the data.
I love it. You know, I spend a lot of time coaching on data-driven decision-making. Businesses will often hide behind what I call weather reporting. Well, I think we're doing pretty good, Tom. Okay.
Right.
Tell me what is making you say that. What objective points of data are you pointing towards to give me that assessment? And weather reporting is top-down leadership. If the owner of the company is giving me a weather report, well, they're going to be a client for a minute because it's going to be a much harder turn. Because I assure you, the leadership and the line staff are also doing weather reporting.
Right. I remember back in the day, I did online marketing consulting.
Okay.
And so the first question I'd ask people is, so what's your value per lead?
Okay.
Right. Or what's your lifetime value of a customer?
Okay.
And they would say, I don't know. And I say, well, until we figure this out, there's nothing else to talk about.
Yeah.
Right. Like when, and when people started paying attention to important metrics.
Yeah.
With, and they could do so without getting their knickers in a twist emotionally.
Okay.
It was almost like they were coaching themselves.
Right.
Like the world is coaching you now.
Yeah. They had a cathartic effect. That's why, to me, the coaching on a thinking error, which that's what you're referring to, versus a behavior error, can be so cathartic. Because once you get people thinking, say, correctly, well, then the thinking errors, their performance rises dramatically. And then maybe they have the same amount of physical errors. You know, like say they have a call. They just did a bad sales call.
Yeah.
All right, you sucked on that sales call. Good, do another call. That's okay. Everyone strikes out. Everybody strikes out. But on that one, with the understanding, it has so much value. I spend a lot of time coaching business leadership to do these three simple things. Three words. I distilled the whole book down to three words. Clear, simple, compelling. And there's a difference between being clear and simple. I want you to fly to Jupiter. That's clear. Mm-hmm. That ain't simple. Okay? So clear, simple, and compelling. And if you as a leader are communicating through that lens, or you're speaking through that megaphone, then you're going to have good outcomes. That I spend a lot of time on that.
Nice.
One of my faves, actually. And I get the most feedback on that.
Uh-huh.
And people tell me that it has affected their outcomes the most. Be clear, be simple. Because if people, like in that example, if the sales staff you were coaching weren't compelled by what you were sharing, then it wouldn't impact them. But what you said was very compelling. The question was, hey, what's the downline? Like, what's the ultimate value of this activity? People like to make money. That's a compelling argument.
Right.
We don't have clarity and we don't have simplicity around it. Let's get it.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
See, we're a little over an hour, so I like to give people a break.
Okay.
anything I didn't ask about or I should have? Anything?
I had a great time and I'm happy to chop it up anytime if you get feedback where people are like, hey, I like this part. I'd like you guys to take on a specific subject. Mm-hmm. Someone want to play Stump the Chump with us and send us a business dilemma.
Okay.
And say, hey, we got a real business and we're struggling with this. Give it to Howie and Tom and we'll chop it up.
Okay.
They just need to give us this much info and we can run with it.
Nice. I mean, I know already that the feedback I'm going to get is that Tom didn't say fuck enough. So I'm already bracing for that.
My bad. in the future, if I need to not do that, I can.
Oh,
do that.
Hell no!
Oh, really? I'm cleared hot.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. Yeah.
No,
okay.
I have the setting on my Apple Podcast is explicit content. That's just the default.
Oh, I was behaving too much today. Then, yeah.
Yeah. No, you're fine.
I was too well behaved. Yeah, but I would love to actually play Stump the Chump with you, where we're the chump, and have people send us business dilemmas that they actually have.
Uh-huh.
And they're probably, if your listeners are more like, you know, like leaders and supervisors, they'll have like staff who are driving them crazy.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I'd love to take on some of those.
Well,
we can even do a call-in too.
Uh-huh.
I'd be cool with that.
Yeah, I mean, this podcast is largely sort of, you know, health-based.
Sure.
But these are people who also have businesses and work in businesses.
Yeah, they could have a client who's not, you know, making progress, whatever it is. We can play Stop the Chump on that.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
And talk about your book and where people can get it, and also if people want to find out more about your work.
Oh, I'd love this. So Task, Performance-Based Communication. Look at that. There we go. You can get that on Amazon. Just type it out in the search box. Task, Performance-Based Communication, and it gets printed on demand. Like, I decided when I made the book not to print them because I knew me. I would just be like, I wanted to divorce myself of that process.
Yeah.
So to me, this is the little book that could, meaning like that little train that here's what I tell people. Get the book, and if you don't get one thing that helps you improve your communication, I'll send you your fucking money back. Now, that's actually a lie. Like, I'm not going to do that. But I say that. But no, I'm joking. Honestly, if someone, like, harassed me, I would give them the money back. Yeah. But the feedback is that there's at least one thing in there.
Yeah. I was wondering because I looked in the back and it was like, you know, it printed like the date 4 days before I received it.
Yeah,
like,
that's right. It's on-demand printing. It's pretty cool.
On-demand. Yeah, it's also nice that you don't have a garage full of books saying, you didn't sell me. Like, I've been there.
And I want to encourage people, like I'm not supposed to say this, but buy the book and then give it to somebody when you're done with it. Like, I don't really, like, I care, but I donate the money anyway, like, to be frank, like the way I do my finances. So it's like, I'd rather have people propagate the material. And the only way to do that is have people read it.
Right.
You know, so that's, I also, the reason I did this size is that people can put it in a stocking for holidays.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a stocking stuffer.
Stocking stuffer.
Do you not want your family to be better communicators? Buy the book.
Right. That way I don't have to actually talk to them about it.
No, who wants to talk?
Excellent. And what about your business? Who do you work with?
You know, so I work with all sorts of companies, private, public. I've worked with institutions, learning institutions. So the way to get a hold of me, if you're on Instagram, is Toomey Reed. So it's T-O-O-M-Y. There's a story why I go with that nickname. I won't get into it this show, but if you have me back, I promise to tell the story
okay.
of how I got the nickname Toomey.
Toomey.
So it's Toomey Reed.
That's R-E-I-D.
Thank you for that point of clarification. So it's at Toomey Reed on Instagram. If you want to email me directly, it's TOMREID7@iCloud. I decided to go just very generic with my consulting because for many years I own and ran other companies, and I decided to go just sort of off the reservation, just keep it super low key. Like, uh-huh. I'm not trying to be XYZ.com consulting group.
Uh-huh.
My mission, like, I work with former world champions. Like, I choose who I work with because I'm super passionate about helping people who are super passionate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just being, you know, but I would love to hear from people, though. If you're passionate, I want to hear from you.
Sounds good.
Yep.
All right, man. Let's wave goodbye. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for all you do. Thanks for being a great on-field captain for our team.
I appreciate it.
You've helped me personally a great deal, and you're a great inspiration.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody watching out there and listening, and I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Hope you enjoyed that. If you want to find out more about Tom, about performance-based communication, or anything we talked about, check out the show notes for today's episode, plantyourself.com/491. So movement news, went for a nice 4-mile jog. I jogged almost the entire way. And played some ultimate practice in the Cole 3-on-3 on Saturday. And now the difference is I'm wearing a Whoop, W-H-O-O-P. It's one of these wearables. My buddy and frequent podcast co-conspirator Glenn Murphy lent me his. So Whoop is one of these wearables. It's supposed to tell you, like, how well you've recovered from yesterday's exertion, how well you slept, what your heart rate variability is, how much you've worked out, and to kind of give you guidance on how hard you should go today. So I'm paying attention to that. I have had crappy sleep for about a week and a half now since the time change, really. I don't know why 1 hour has made such a difference or whether it was just coincidental and something else is going on, but I'm trying to get my sleep back. I'm waking up 2:30 in the morning and then really struggling to go back to sleep, and it is taking its toll. Garden news, did some preparing of beds. The strawberries are nice and in, that we were watering them. Garlic's going in probably in the next couple of weeks, and slowly but surely clearing out the fall garden. So things are looking a little bit cleaner in there. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filikanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gil Assert, David Donahue, Blair Cyber, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iaconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.